So there's a lot packed into these 12 verses. I hope everybody read all of them and read the commentary on the verses we didn't cover, because there's a lot of interesting material there. So the first question really covers the entirety of what we're reading tonight. What is the difference between a beatitude and a proverb? And Trace, I believe you are the first one. Would you like to answer what the difference between a beatitude and a proverb is?
I'll give a few ideas. The beatitudes are kind of a pronouncement of blessings due to practicing Christ-like characteristics. That's kind of the best way I could summarize it. And for the Proverbs, they can be good or bad, but they're mostly teachings like life lessons. They're very instructional and very direct, but they're very useful. So I don't know. There is a difference, and I suppose that's it. The Beatitudes are more like Christ-like behaviorisms, and the Proverbs are kind of just life lessons. That's the best way I could put
it. Very good, thank you. Yeah, it seems like one of the definitions I saw of Proverbs was a simple traditional saying that expresses truth, usually based on common sense. The beatitude really kind of runs contrary to common sense, what you would traditionally think of common sense. Who else would like to address what a beatitude is and how it differs from a proverb? Austin.
One thing I noticed was the fact that it's the beatitudes are listed as absolute certainties, whereas you look at a proverb is... often referred to as a general truth. For example, in Proverbs 14, verse 21, says, "He that despises his neighbor sinneth, but he that hath mercy on the poor, happy is he." Now, that's a general truth. It's possible for one not to be happy and still have mercy on the poor. And the most famous one I think we can agree on is Proverbs 22, verse 6, "Train up a child in the way he should go when he's old, and he should not depart from it." That's not an absolute truth, but it's a general truth. There are exceptions to that rule. The Beatitudes are listed as absolute certainties, things that will happen and things that will receive God's blessing instead of perhaps just happiness and peace in this life.
Thank you. Who else would like to address Beatitudes and Proverbs? Bart.
Yeah, I completely agree with what has been said by everyone. And maybe one more thing is that, as has been pointed out, the Proverbs are pithy maxims of common sense that, you know, would apply to everyone in the world, whereas the Beatitudes have sort of an eschatological application. In other words, Jesus is preaching about the kingdom of heaven being near, and now he's setting up a gateway for entrance into the kingdom of heaven. You can't enter into the kingdom of heaven unless you're poor in spirit, unless you're meek, and you're a peacemaker, and so on. Those are things that, or at least you don't prosper in the kingdom if you're not these things. So it has an immediate fulfillment in the kingdom of heaven, whereas these pithy maxims and common sense proverbs didn't necessarily. Obviously, they do in a sense. A godly person is not going to listen to the fool, or person is not going to run after the murderer and walk in their steps. But still, I think there is, Jesus is giving, he's, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, and so he's really, these eschatological principles apply to those who want to be part of the kingdom of heaven.
Thank you. Anybody else I want to be up to? Dennis.
Characteristics I think that are essential to everyone who wants to be a follower is these teachings of our description of what every Christian is meant to be. And one who lives his life this way is going to be truly blessed or happy in the purest sense of the word. The first beatitude to the last have the same reward, which is to inherit the kingdom of heaven. He starts with that. He starts and ends with this to help you realize that they belong to a different kingdom. They are not of this world, and their lives are going to be different from those that are in the world. Proverbs, practical insights, and guidelines for life teach the whole truth, and also the main theme of what Bart was talking about. Proverbs it's nature of true wisdom can apply to anybody who's ever missionary except to be a follower of Christ.
Thank you. I like to point out that the first and the last have the same blessing. I saw, I think it was James Fawcett and Brown were talking about, that was like 8 blessings, but 7 rewards, and you know, got into the perfect 7 type stuff, which is kind of interesting. Anybody else? You know, this is one of these words that, this is the only place we ever say beatitude, and it's comes from a Greek base. It means happy or blessed. Bill.
Just real quick, I didn't appreciate that there were beatitudes in the Old Testament. You know, Psalms 32, verses 1 and 2, blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is a man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. So, I learned an appreciation for beatitudes in the Old Testament. There's 6 or 8 different passages that were referenced.
Didn't realize that either until right now. Thank you. Anybody else? Okay, the next one seemed kind of confusing to me as well. Which year of Jesus' ministry does the Sermon on the Mount take place? Malin, would you like this question?
My study material didn't really talk about an exact, it didn't nail down an exact time period or anything, but we know that Jesus had just been tempted by Satan in the wilderness in chapters 4, verses 1 through 11. And I think we talked about this last week, the difference between verses 11 and 12 of chapter 4 was about 1 year. I think maybe Bill brought that up. And so we can see that this is probably sometime after that, still early in Jesus' ministry, and right after he'd been baptized by John. I don't know if it's maybe 1 or 2 years after that, but again, I couldn't find an exact date on that. Maybe somebody else has.
I was in the same boat. I looked and I couldn't figure it out. I found several different timelines. Most of them put it at this after the second Passover, and I'm not sure that is accurate, but there was several. Looks like Austin has some information on that. So
it's like, well, when I was getting the questions together, I thought for sure in my mind that it was the start of his second year of ministry. Upon further investigation, it looks to be like the late part of his first year of his ministry. But the point that I was trying to get at was the fact that there's kind of a jump in time, as Malin already referred to, between chapter 4 and the events of chapter 4 and then what we're looking at here in chapter 5. And if you look in Luke chapters 4 through 6, and the first 4 chapters of John, it reveals some information that happened during the first year of his ministry that Matthew leaves out or basically just summarizes there in the last part of chapter 4.
Yeah, it does. When you read this, it seems like it's immediate after. You know, you get the idea that right after the 40 days that he called apostles, and it's kind of confusing. I even got that same idea from Luke too. But anybody else on this time period? Matt, are you raising your hand? Or? Okay, well, let's go on to the third question, which covers a verse. Verse 3, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So what is the kingdom of heaven, and why shall the poor in spirit inherit it? Landon, would you like to answer this question?
So the word kingdom is a prominent word in the New Testament. It's found 162 times, and it comes from the Greek term basileia, if I'm saying that correctly, and it's used predominantly as a synonym for the church that Jesus established. An example of that is Matthew 16:18-19, where he says, I will build my church, I will give unto you the keys of the kingdom. And then when John addressed the seven congregations of Asia, in Revelation 1:4, he informed them that he was a partaker with them in Christ's kingdom. Back in chapter 4, we studied Matthew's records twice that Jesus was teaching about the kingdom of heaven. In verse 17 and 23, he says, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And so the Sermon on the Mount is really about the guidelines for life in the kingdom and the community of the church. And why should the poor in spirit inherit it? Well, being poor in spirit, I think, means to be humble. If you're haughty and boastful, you are not going to be accepted into the church.
Thank you. Who else would like to address what the kingdom is, or why the poor in spirit will inherit it, or both? Matt.
I think we might take for granted what this scene looked like. When Jesus began this speech, there were, we don't know how many people were there, but multitudes, it says, were gathered to hear. Many of them probably believed that Jesus was the Messiah. They were gathered to hear a big speech from the Messiah. This is the first big speech that we have recorded from the Messiah. And what they are expecting it has got to be completely in shambles after this first line, not to mention the entire first paragraph of the Beatitudes. If you could look out on their faces, if you were from the perspective of Jesus, and you see all these people gathered, and they're prepared to hear the speech from the Messiah, and he says, blessed are the humble. They're probably shell-shocked. Blessed are the warriors, because they're going to overthrow the Romans. No, that's not what Jesus says. Jesus is about to turn their entire idea of Messiah upside down. And what that must have, the reaction from the crowd, what that must have looked like and felt like, is totally lost on us just reading the words, but it had to have been incredible.
Very good. It's a different viewpoint than what I had envisioned in my mind. Who else would like to address the poor in spirit or the kingdom of heaven? I appreciate Landon's discussion of the kingdom of heaven. I really didn't have too much on that. I think we see it definitely. The church is the earthly component, it seems like, of the kingdom of heaven. Back in the Old Testament, we have Nebuchadnezzar calling God the kingdom of the heaven in 437. Daniel sought out the God of heaven in Daniel 2:18 and 19. And in the Hebrews 11, where it's talking about the faithful, we have it's a place sought by the faithful in Hebrews 13 and 16. And then, as Landon told us just a minute ago, you know, it's a place that was at hand that we saw in 4 and 17. So the earthly component was at hand. And it seems like those who would be in the church are part of it in Acts 2 and 47. Anybody else on the kingdom? Bill.
Yeah, I agree with what Landon and Matt have said. The kingdom of heaven, it got to be a little hard to define when I started thinking about what's heaven. Of course it's heaven. Well, there's more to it than that. Maybe dig around and think a little bit. You know, it's the abode of Christ, the abode of God, heavenly beings. It's the place that we all seek after. That's our goal, is to be in the kingdom of heaven. But then that whole poor in spirit, that was another heart, as Matt said, he would have turned everybody upside down on what they were expecting to hear. But it's being poor in spirit is a requirement to be able to mourn, to be able to be meek, to be able to comfort. That whole poor in spirit, and that doesn't mean that you're just decrepit, but all haughtiness and pride, you realize that you're totally dependent upon the Lord. And I think that's, and it made me do some thinking, because I think it's something hard for all of us to really, really be poor in spirit. I think that's a difficult place to get to.
Thank you. So both Bill and Landon brought out one of the, I imagine there's multiple opinions, but I saw two primary opinions on what poor in spirit mean. And one of them is what they're talking about, where it's you realize that you're spiritually bankrupt and you have, you need to lay everything on Jesus. And we have an example of this in Luke 18, where the Pharisee and the publican pray, and the publican realize, he's poor in spirit, but the Pharisee's not. The other predominant theory is that it's reflecting poor, where you have the, not necessarily monetarily poor, but you have the spirit of somebody who is monetarily poor, that you don't dwell on earthly wealth, and you realize that what you have is from God, and you're generous and so forth. Would anybody like to address those viewpoints or any others, what poor in spirit means? Dennis.
Okay. Both what Bill said in the first one, it seems to me that they're kind of interlinked. But I think what I can represent the rest of them, you're going to have to empty yourself of the poor in spirit. You're ready to cry for yourself. Like the old wineskins, the new wineskins, you can't put new stuff in the old wineskins. You have to be a new person. Empty yourself, allow these other things so you can mourn.
Very good. Thank you. Anybody else before we move on to the next question? Question number 4 concerns verse 5. And it says, "Why should the meek be concerned about inheriting the earth?" And verse 5 reads, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Levi, would you like to answer this question?
Sure. I think I'm not really answering the question. I think I'm just going to try and feel out what it means. I'm not sure what why they would be concerned about inheriting the earth, but I'm going to try and answer what it means. I didn't realize that's what the question actually said until before, but... So I'm kind of following Mike Criswell's commentary. I think it's pretty good. As for the "for they shall inherit the earth," I think it's not teaching two things. I don't think it's teaching that Jesus' kingdom will be an earthly kingdom. Despite what the Jews wanted, I think Jesus is definitely not teaching that it's an earthly kingdom. And it's also not teaching that inheriting the earth refers to, like, material prosperity. And so I just want to throw out two possibilities of what it could mean to inherit the earth. It could mean the church, and it could also mean heaven. I think Mike believes that it's heaven, but
okay. Thank you. I think you sort of answered the question. Who else would like to answer the question, either impartial or whole?
Well,
Austin.
Frankly, I think Levi, as far as I'm concerned, answered it very well. But also, this is a quote from the book of Psalms. The 37th Psalm, verse 9, talks about, "For evildoers shall be cut off, but those that wait upon the Lord, they shall inherit the earth. For yet a little while, and the wicked shall not be. Yea, thou shalt diligently consider his place, and it shall not be. But the meek shall inherit the earth, and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace." So it's not that the meek are going to inherit real estate, per se, I don't believe. I think it's either talking about, and J.W. McGarvey says in his commentary, they'll inherit in two ways, that they shall enjoy it more fully while in it, or number two, they shall finally, as part of the triumphant church, possess and enjoy it, and doubtless that there's a reference to complete possession to be fulfilled in the new earth, that is, in heaven. I always think of this verse. It's in one of the Western movies that I like. It says that the meek shall, they ain't going to inherit anything west of Chicago. So I don't think that's what this verse is talking about, just real estate. I think it's a little bit deeper than that.
Thank you. We also like to address Mark.
Yeah, I totally agree with what everybody's said, and, you know, either the church or heaven. And in regard to the church, in a sense, Adam and Eve, of course, had paradise on earth, and they sinned, and they were cast out of paradise. And so their portion of earth was shrunk because of their sin. And in a sense, the meek, if you keep this in the context of what we've been talking about, that, you know, perhaps predominantly this is speaking of the kingdom of heaven being the church, paradise has been reestablished on earth. The second Adam has succeeded where the first Adam failed. And entry has been once again given to those who will obey and seek after God. And entry into paradise, and I'm not saying obviously, you know, everything's perfect and the sin is gone. But in a sense, it isn't, you know, the paradise that God is, it is the inheritance. You know, often there's an inheritance now, but there's also an inheritance in heaven. So it's just interesting to me that if you keep these blessings, these beatitudes in the context, it seems that there is a place of refuge. There, you know, it's the Old Testament, Deuteronomy and Numbers, a city of refuge. There is a place that the faithful can flee to and not, you know, not be murdered, not be destroyed by the destroyer. And that is this place. And we all know, we spoke about it in our study, outside these doors, outside the family of God, it's destruction on every hand in this world. And we see it on the left and the right every day. And this is the only place among the faithful of God that we have respite. And so in a sense, we have inherited the earth because paradise has been restored. And that paradise is forgiveness of sins. That's all that really matters. Not the earth itself, the literal earth, but the forgiveness of sins and repentance and redemption from the destruction we deserve.
Thank you. Anybody else? Matt.
The word earth here, I don't want to go too much longer on this question, but the word earth here doesn't mean earth in the way that we think about it initially, like a planet. The Greek word ge means anything from ground, soil, region to earth, as you would think of it in terms of the land, not necessarily the whole world. And with the context being, of course, starting with the kingdom, there's this, the kingdom, and it keeps coming back to the kingdom. Well, what land, what region is being inherited here? That would be the region of the kingdom, the ground of the kingdom. So it seems to me that what everyone else has said is correct.
So when I looked at the commentary, I saw two different main viewpoints. Most everybody here has gone for the viewpoint on the left-hand side. Austin touched briefly on what we have here on the right-hand side. So left-hand side, we have meek shall inherit the earth. And we have in the Old Testament, you know, inheritance was associated with land. So Exodus 3:17. But we more spiritualize that in the New Testament. 2 Peter 3:13, a new heaven and a new earth. The faithful patriarchs look for a heavenly country. Hebrews 11:16. And in 1 Corinthians 10, we have this metaphor of the journey of Israel as our spiritual journey, which, you know, that's kind of what we see here and what most people have talked about. On the other hand, it could be not necessarily real estate, either east or west of Chicago, but it could be an earthly concept in that the meek are not seeking, they're not as angry, they're not as competitive, and they get to truly enjoy what the earth brings about. They get to enjoy the things of the earth because they're not worrying and they're not so concerned about keeping ahead that they prosper in this life. I thought about this when maybe a little bit connected to both of them. We see in Numbers 12:13, I can't read my notes, that Moses was the meekest man alive at that time. I thought about how that, you know, kind of going back to 1 Corinthians 10, he lost his promise because of his one time that he wasn't meek. When he struck the rock that second time, you know, he lost his promise. But then we also see that he, that's in Numbers 20 and 10, we also see that he enjoyed the things of the earth. When he died, it said he was full of vigor and stronger than, you know, when he was a young man. I thought that was kind of an interesting comparison to what we see here. Okay, let's move on to... Oh, I see what the pattern is. We have odd verses. Let's move on to verse number 9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. What does it mean to be a peacemaker? And what kind of peace is Jesus expecting his disciples to accomplish? This covers verse 9. And Bart, would you like to answer this question?
Yes. Well, Christ is the Prince of Peace, Isaiah 9:6, so it is proper then that the citizens of his kingdom are peacemakers, and so persons without this attitude need not apply. It is a fruit of the Spirit, Galatians 5:22. How are we to be peacemakers in our life? And there's so many ways that we're to be peacemakers. We do that in our personal lives. I thought about fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Primary responsibility of dads. And we see that everywhere in our culture now, absent dads provoking children to wrath and all the terrible things that are happening. Not provoking your wife to wrath. And obviously it works the other way too. And so we do it in our personal lives. We do it when we interact with people in the church, and we make it a priority not to put ourselves front and center and to promote ourselves. We don't talk about people, we don't gossip about people, we try to cover the transgressions of others when we can and bear with the weak. There's so many ways that happens. We try to resolve strife between other individuals in the best way we can. But primarily, I think, all those things are true, but primarily it's through preaching God's word or teaching it, living it out in our lives, trying to attract other people to peace with God, because that's the primary peace. Peace on earth, when the angels appeared to the shepherds, they said peace on earth. And that peace is primarily the peace. We have peace in the kingdom, but it's primarily the peace that we have. Our inheritance, the church, allows us to have peace with God. The enmity that we should have with God has been erased because of Christ. So we help others. We do our best to promote that sort of peace in another people's life. And it goes against the thread of this world, because people gossip. We see it all the time. People are destructive in the way they deal with others. And as young people, wreaking havoc in other people's lives through indiscretion, as middle-aged and older people, we can continue to do it. And Jesus simply says, always be a peacemaker, and then you will be called the Son of God.
Very good. Thank you. Who else would like to address what it means to be a peacemaker and how Jesus expects his disciples to accomplish it?
Something was pointed out to me is that it's not just someone who wants peace or someone who hopes that there's peace, but it's someone who makes peace. It's an active thing that goes on. I think in that is the willingness to do things that maybe aren't pleasant. Whether it's tough love, whether it's doing things that might be awkward or difficult, but in order to be someone who makes peace, you have to sometimes, I think, do things that you may not want to do but are necessary for peace.
Right. And I think that comes kind of to the later portion of this sermon and the more physical, earthly portion of it is, you know, he said, leave your gift at the altar and go make peace with your brother, which is a difficult thing to do, and love your enemies. It's very difficult. Anybody else on this? So that, as an active maker of peace, what Bart was talking about, what he considers the primary application of forgiveness of sins, you know, this peace, it breaks down the separation between God and man. So spreading the gospel is an active participant being a peacemaker. Anybody else want to address what it means to be a peacemaker? What Jesus meant by it? Okay, let's go on to last questions. Last question. Why should Christians not be afraid of persecution? And this covers verses 10 to 12. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Logan, if you'd like to answer this question.
It is essential that a Christian has an eternal perspective. If you don't have this, many things aren't going to be very clear to you about what Jesus is saying here. It says, and we're going to get to this later in a couple of weeks, but not necessarily a couple, actually probably several. But in Matthew 10, verse 28, it says, "Do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body." So it's this recognition of man can't do anything to me. It's Jesus and God that ultimately, that is what matters here. And one of the coolest things, I think, growing up, you know, learning about Dad and Mom teaching me about Jesus is the fact that, you know, as a kid, you fear all kinds of things, but you're afraid of what these horror stories, terror attacks, whatever. And one of the coolest things growing up is you don't have to worry about that. You know, you're going to go to heaven. You believe in Jesus and follow his commandments. So, having an eternal perspective, I would say.
Very good. Thank you. Who else would like to address why Christians should not be afraid of persecution? Bill.
Well, this isn't, I felt like I needed a little bit of clarity. This isn't persecution here that this isn't persecution that's indeed deserved, or random persecution, or persecution based on some demographic. It's not that at all. In verse 10, because persecution, persecution, why should a Christian not be afraid of persecution? Because persecution suffered because of righteousness, that's living godly, gives a blessing to the victim. So, you know, we blessings are there for those that are persecuted righteously, because of their righteousness, I guess I should say. Paul told Timothy that all who live godly will suffer persecution, 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 12. Verse 11, similar to verse 10, you know, three ways that evil people can persecute a Christian. They can revile the Christian with words and insults. They can persecution, physical violence, bodily harm. And then lastly, that manner of evil, falsely accused, slandered, rumors. Those are three ways. And then verse 12, Christ reminds his listeners that so did they persecute the prophets. And so, you know, we were talking before services. There's a lot of different ways, and if you think about it, there's different ways that the church or us individually are persecuted today. And not necessarily with violence, although that's a possibility at some point in time as well.
Right. Anybody else? So I think we've covered both of, you know, there's several ways to look at this. We don't have to fear as both Logan and Bill brought out. The other thing, Bill marked out a little bit, is that the prophets were persecuted and, you know, they were righteous, so we can look to them to know we're on the right path when we are persecuted for righteousness. That it's not something abnormal to true religion to be persecuted. Anybody else on this question before we close?